Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, the Clifton Triangle Poltergeist. Plus, we hear from 1950s TV and radio boffin Norman Ellis. He's also former GCHQ and helped on the Channel Tunnel. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But first, Steve Lacey. He's a Bristol artist and he had an experience, he says, of a poltergeist on 4 to 5 Clifton Triangle South. The most recent incarnation of that building was the Grand City Chinese Restaurant, but it happened to him a long time ago when it was still called the Chopsticks Chinese Restaurant. That is in between the Oz Restaurant and now Zizzy's. It's still, I believe, a sort of derelict building. But anyway, let's let Steve Lacey, Bristol artist, tell the tale.
My name's Steve Lacey. Back in the 70s... we had a few problems at the restaurant, basically the Poltergeist experience. It's called the Chopstick Chinese Restaurant on the Triangle South back in the 70s. Then it became the Grand City.
Which part of the Triangle is that and what's there now?
That's at the top of Park Street and it's on the Triangle South. And now it's derelict. We're looking for someone to buy the place.
Maybe it's not been sold because of the poltergeist is still there.
Probably. There were rumours that it was there in the 90s and the 2000s, so more than likely.
For a lot of people don't believe in this kind of thing. Is there anything you could say to convince people?
Luckily, it wasn't just me. We were cooking one night and different people have different explanations for this. The Chinese call it Bei Guai Jat. It's when the spirit suppresses you down, be it on the staircase or in the room, on the floor as you sleep, and then about 3 minutes you can't talk, you can't breathe. The medical term is sleep paralysis, but obviously when it leaves a black mark like you've been punched by Mike Tyson, it didn't happen to just me, it happened to three other chefs who then decided to drive home, and I decided to run home to Fishponds after that. First experience that happened back then. And then obviously, because you left the house, you didn't work there, you left the restaurant trade. And then there were years of nothing really happening. And then I decided to put what I found into art, the way of expressing the subconscious mind, how you receive things, how you perceive things, you know, and they start making models to that effect, you know.
So you're, in a way, you're getting visions of some sort. You know, you're basically seeing things. The idea is, rather than just then forget about it, to actually try and do something with that, express it artistically.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've done. I expressed how it kind of works, how you receive it, what part of your mind you get it in layman's term, and then put it into models to emphasise how you see things. For example, if you're to see a flash vision and happen to run into the future, then maybe the past, present and the future are all interconnected and you just flash vision of something that's ready to record but not yet manifested. So I made models to that effect. More or less, you roll into the future, but in reality, it's kind of behind you. You're rolling into the future, which is the past.
Well, it sounds to me like some sort of time machine.
I think we're in a huge time machine, and this is it.
What was the first actual artwork that you did, though? Because it's not paintings or anything. It's three-dimensional art you're doing, isn't it? What was the first thing?
Yeah, the first thing I'd done was what we call the Rock of Truth. I wanted to have a hobby because I couldn't sleep at night, you know, insomnia. So I thought, I'll do painting. And I was down in Weymouth one night, I seen these door stoppers on rocks. So I'll try and paint a rock, you know. So painting, well, I couldn't do it. I'm rubbish at painting. So then I thought, why don't I just make something or put something on there, how I feel, how I think the existence is. So then I started writing this stuff and I built a rock with a computer coming out of it and I've called it the Rock of Truth. And on it, if I can remember what I wrote, this existence is multidimensional. To understand it, you need to look at the past, present, and the future. They're all interconnected. And knowing in advance would change nothing, because it's only a matter of consciousness, which is temporary state of mind, not anything that you own. And that's basically what I put on the rock.
Must have been quite a big rock.
No, it wouldn't.
It's a tiny rock. Tiny, you have to have a magnifying glass to read it.
My daughter wrote it, so yeah. She's quite good, a little tiny bit of writing.
And then you decided that rather than try and do paintings, you would do this, I suppose, what you call conceptual art. That is to say, it's something that you could stick on a table, for example.
That's right, yeah. And some got quite big, like the subconscious mind one got very big. I welded a big globe together and I put all the events that happened over the past, all around the whole thing. And then coming down into the subconscious mind, I had bought a head from a medical company, open that up and put the picture into the head, so when you receive it, it comes from this huge database of past, present and future existences, so different planes, different levels, and then you can either tap into the past or the future. Very similar to remote viewing, like people talking about. Mainly people get flash visions or warnings or even dreams. It's not as complex as people think. It's dreams that enter the subconscious mind and then you see it. And then sometimes you roll into it, which we can call premonition, vision, prophecy. Any name is the same thing, I believe. It's the same thing, but in a different format.
But the thing is, for most of us, dreams are just like gobbledygook. They're nonsense that doesn't really seem to make any sense.
Oh, yeah, I quite agree. I quite agree. But sometimes there are these flash visions we get, or premonitions, or even that feeling something's going to happen today. You know, I'll tell you a quick story. I was on the buses working for a Bristol City bus, and I had a premonition there's going to be a fight, angry, you know, on a Friday night. I thought, oh my God, this feeling won't go away the whole day. So I paid someone who was playing a fruit machine to £5 to change journeys and go the other way. So rather than going to Knowle, I went to Loch Lees.
And the idea being that Loch Lees is a bit safer, is it?
A bit safer, and I thought. Changing my destiny, so I'm going away from what I could foresee or feeling I got. And lo and behold, we get past Cumberland Road. Oh, it all starts, kicks off, ambulances, police, and I pay to go into my destiny. It could be coincidence, but I mean, that's one incident.
Well, just tell us what had happened on the bus that night.
Oh, the Knowle people had to get off before the Whitchurch, and they were at the back. And the witch's lot went to front, and it was one remark, you know how it works. One remark, ooh, oh yeah, bang, 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 and that's it, blood, police, bottles, and everything. And your usual Friday night.
So your time machine, can you use it to look into the future for Bristol?
Okay, Ferguson, scrap this parking. There's number one. No, I met him at Chinese New Year, he's all right. No, at the moment, well, it doesn't work that kind of way, you know, you just plod on regardless, you know.
Isn't that a bit of a cop-out, though? Because, I mean, if you're saying that you're sometimes seeing these things that happen in the future, you know, everybody wants to know, Steve, you know, and if you can get it right, then we can say Steve's a genius. And if it doesn't work out, this is the test, isn't it, really?
Yeah. On my street, I help out people and go and give them lifts there, you know. And we need to do more of this, more, much more, you know. Look out for them, look out for the elderly people, look out for the young people, do you know what I mean? Encourage the young people. A lot of the time, the young people are angry because no one's paying any attention to them. So I totally agree with you, yeah.
What about the youth? I mean, have you got children yourself?
My children are quite old now, but the young ones, I spend a lot of time with young ones, you know, with my models and work I do, and encourage them, and I spend a lot of time with them. I enjoy with young people. They're quite smart. They're more smart than what you think, you know. And it's nice to be with the younger lot, you know.
And you think that there's, even though the future is a bit dark, that actually there's something positive to say to the young people. How do you encourage them?
Well, I just say to them, we come together, look at each other, stay on the right path. You will get on. And luckily, a lot of the young people can snap into this kind of way of thinking, you know. We talk about corruption with the government and the local establishments. They know. They know something's dreadfully wrong. And they don't need any much private, you know. They know what's going on. They know the corruption side of things. And I think together with the young, we can overcome this.
Steve, where can people find your artwork? I know you've got a book out, for example, haven't you? It might cost a little bit, but And are you likely to be exhibiting in the city centre? I know you had an exhibition a couple of years ago.
Yeah, there's a website you can go on called Unassimilated Research Group. That's on Facebook.
That's a bit of a complicated one. Unassimilated Research Group. Okay.
Yeah. And that's got all our local stuff we're doing now on. Plus, it's got all the stuff that we highlight to do with all kind of stuff, Bilderberg, New World Order, you know, all kind of music stuff, you know, music agenda, where they're going with their stuff, which is quite important for young people.
Well, just explain that for a minute. That's something we hadn't touched on, the music agenda. What is the music agenda?
I think it's the people behind the music that it's gone almost satanic. It's got a theme to it, which is dark, and we need to lighten that up a bit. We need positive role models in the music business, not all doing the same thing. You know, covering the eye and doing your triangle. And that has to, we have to have an alternative. And I think when that do come, it'd be healthy. And people will embrace that. You know, at the moment, you probably don't realise it. It goes along with the society, gloomy. You know, we need this uplifting, you know. Secret Prophecy, Steve Lacy, it will come up. But we're trying to get a smaller version so we can make it more affordable for people.
Brilliant, Steve. Well, thanks ever so much for joining us. Any thoughts about when your artworks are going to be exhibited in the city next?
I don't know. My wife and my mother give me a hard time about my models. They were big, and I really find it difficult to go and make some more. But posters, I might do a little poster exhibition in the very near future, but I will keep you posted.
Okay. Thanks, Steve Lacy, very much.
Thank you, Tony.
The Blue Orchids there from 1993 with The Butterfly Effect. be lovely to hear one day. I'm sure John Peel did a session with them, and the Peel session version of their songs was fantastic. If anyone can track it down, do send it in to BCFM or find Dialect online at dialectradio.co.uk and let us know. That was also Steve Lacey. We ought to just remind you, the Bristol artist there. The address of his so-called poltergeist experience was 4-5 Clifton Trigall South. That is most recently incarnated as the Grand City Chinese Restaurant. When Steve was working there, it was called the Chopsticks Chinese Restaurant, and it's in between the Oz Restaurant and Ziggy's on Clifton Trigall South. And you'll find Steve online and on Facebook. Online, it's Unassimilated Research Group, UNASSIMILATED, Unassimilated Research Group, .blogspot.co.uk. He's also another one, which is unassimilated.blog.com, the same spelling, unassimilated.blog.com, and you'll find him also on Facebook, Unassimilated Research Group.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
These days, Government Communication Headquarters in Cheltenham is synonymous with whistleblower Edward Snowden, who's proven how Britain's Secret Service eavesdropping agency actually works. Firstly, how they've set themselves up the objective of hacking into everybody's laptops and smartphones, gathering private details on all of us, and the other, that they've crossed the line into criminality under the cloak of national security, bypassing court orders the law says they must have to do these things. But GCHQ, as it's known, was not always so highly criticised, and back in late 2012, I met up with 88-year-old semi-retired GCHQ employee Norman Ellis. Norman began his working life as a civil servant boffin, working for something called the Post Office Radio Research Establishment in a hut, in a field, in Castleton near Newport, and another one in Backwell near Bristol. Along with his colleagues, his task back in the 1950s was to bring the first live television pictures from London to Cardiff. Norman went on to get involved with the first satellites and then to write the textbook on everything from the buzzing sounds we hear disturbing our radio listening to the effects on our everyday gadgets of nuclear weapons, the Electrical Interference Handbook.
My name is Norman Ellis. I'm retired 4 times and I'm 88 now. I've been in communications for the whole of my career, starting with the Post Office Radio Research Establishment, progressing from there through GCHQ, and eventually ending up as a consultant on communications and electrical interference, which sounds very erudite, but it isn't really. It's just common sense.
Now, you're also the author of the Electrical Interference Handbook, Norman. Sounds like a bit of a boring title, but I've just had a flick through. It's actually quite interesting, isn't it? And a lot of what we hear today, for example, people are listening on the radio, they hear this click, 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 click noise. That's people's mobile phones interfering. And often if you're listening on medium wave and long wave on ordinary radio, you can hear annoying noises. But you've actually studied that quite a lot and written a book about it, which I noticed online, even secondhand, is selling for over £50. So someone must still be interested in the subject.
That's why it's not selling, because it's £50. Actually, there's an interesting point there. If you drive down to Folkestone on the motorway, you pass under some overhead cables, which are coming in effect from France. They're supplying power from France to England, but you have to transmit it at direct current rather than AC for technical reasons. And as you go underneath those wires, you will hear a noise in your long-wave radio on your car, and directly underneath it disappears because both sides are cancelling one another out. And it's an example of what happens when you get interfering electrical atmospheric conditions.
So when do you get most interference on the radio then? Because we don't get much interference at all, really, on FM, on VHF, what they used to call VHF. We'll talk about digital maybe in a minute, but what about on long wave and medium wave?
Well, on long wave and medium wave, you're using a different modulation technique for the VHF, very high frequencies, and FM, which is that sort of frequency, is round about 100 megahertz. The type of modulation is different. it's less vulnerable to interference than it is on the long wave and medium wave transmissions. It's mainly because of the way the signal's impressed onto the radio. As I speak, this is audio frequencies, the frequencies you can hear. In order to impress those on a radio frequencies, you have to, what they call, modulate it, and it depends how you do it. By using frequency modulation, which is used for FM, which is what FM stands for, you minimise the risk of interference.
You also look at the vulnerability of Britain to a nuclear bomb, don't you? Because that's quite interesting. If a nuclear bomb ever does go off, God forbid, but if it does, it's going to really interfere, isn't it, with a lot of our electrical equipment?
It depends where and how much and so forth. If you take a 1 megaton bomb and you happen to let it off at 35K above the Earth's surface...
Well, that's 35,000 feet, yeah.
Yes, say. It generates an enormous electrical field in the air due to the molecules rushing about, if you like, as the explosion occurs. And this field is so enormous that it can damage things like television sets. It'll do it over a radius of up to about 1,000 miles from the centre of impact. Now, when the explosion occurs at that height, you're unlikely to hear very much. You won't suffer from a blast effect. You might see a twinkle in the sky, but that's about it. But the major effect will be electronic. And for modern defence systems used by the Army, Navy and Air Force, of course they rely on communications. Now, if that event happened there, unless they use protected equipment, then they could be damaged, and therefore they lose the capability of communication.
Even our cars nowadays have got lots of electronic circuitry in, so you can imagine a bomb going off a motorway with cars speeding along 80, 90 miles an hour. Pretty much at the same time, all of those cars, electronic systems, would just conk out, wouldn't they? I mean, there's all sorts of maybe other things we haven't really thought about with these electromagnetic pulses.
Yes, the electromagnetic pulses are only going to occur in times of war anyway. But already, because of the electronic gear on cars, on modern cars, they have sensors checking the speed, checking the traction between different wheels, checking the atmosphere for the engine and so forth. All of that is electronically controlled. Now, because of that, there are standards of interference suppression. So there are two aspects. First of all, it mustn't radiate outwards to interfere with anybody else, but also it mustn't be susceptible to radiation from other people. An example of that is where two cases come to mind. One is where somebody was using a CB radio, a citizen band radio, in his car, and he noticed that when he pulled up to the pumps at a petrol station, he was able to get free petrol because the interference from his transmitter was overcoming the protection in the pumps. This had been overcome. Another one was more serious, where that sort of radiation from a transmitter interfered with the braking system and someone was killed from a car. Also, the overflying of fighter aircraft over powerful radio stations, particularly one in Germany, modern fighter aircraft are very carefully stabilized, controlled. If anything electronic interferes with that, then mayhem can happen. And we did lose a couple of aircraft over Germany due to overflying powerful radio systems. Doesn't always happen, and of course every time it happens there's an investigation and special precautions are built into the new equipment.
We're so reliant on these little integrated circuits now, which are so vulnerable to these pulses, aren't they?
Yes. Luckily, the integrated circuits can be specifically designed to minimise this risk. So, and everything that is manufactured and sold in UK must pass the standards. even if it's manufactured in China, India or America, it has to pass English standards of resistance to interference and to stop it interfering with anything else.
Now, Norman, one of your first jobs was to do with the radio research establishment. Can you just tell us who they were and where you were doing that?
Well, I was a boy. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was interested in things scientific. And my mother wanted me to have a job which had some prospects of perhaps technical background. She saw an advert wanting trainees to join the post office radio research establishment. And I went for an interview. I had no degree, and it was unlikely that I would end up in a university. However, I was interviewed and got the job as a youth in training at what was called the Post Office Radio Research Establishment at Castleton, which is halfway between Newport and Cardiff in South Wales. This establishment consisted of two wooden huts in a field, separated by maybe 100 yards. They were offshoots of the main research at Dollis Hill in London, which had been evacuated at the beginning of the war to ensure that the work of the post office would carry on. The post office at that time was an engineering establishment, not just a stamp-issuing outfit. The radio research at Castleton had a similar one at Backwall near Bristol. Again, a couple of wooden huts in the field. And again, people from Dollis Hill were established. And I was the first local person to be recruited in South Wales. When you start as a youth in training in the post office, at that time, the post office was in the civil service. Later, when there was a change of government, the government wanted to reduce the amount of civil servants. And therefore, they removed the post office from the civil service, made no difference to the pay or the prospects or anything, but it meant a reduction in the civil service of 250,000 people at a stroke. However, the work at the post office radio research in Castleton was mostly in the very high frequency range, that is, FM, if you like, and we were concerned with making things to enable many, many telephone channels to be broadcast over one radio frequency. So we arranged it to have 2,500 or 2,400 telephone channels on one transmitter, if you like. That amount of bandwidth or frequency availability was also suitable for transmitting television. And so you could either have on the one radio broadcast that number of telephone channels or one television channel.
Now, am I right in thinking, now we've got digital TV, but we did have UHF, that original black and white TV back after the Second World War was actually VHF, the same frequency as our modern FM radio.
Yes, that's correct. Anyway, we had this experimental link which went from Castleton to our neighbours in the other side of the Bristol Channel at Backwall. And then we extended that through multiple hops, that is 25-mile intervals, all the way down to London to establish a communication link experimentally from South Wales to London. It so happened that it was a time when television was becoming national rather than local, and the BBC at that time wanted to transmit television to Wales. And here we had this experimental link coupling London to a place near Cardiff, and so it was ideal as an experimental thing to start off with before any cable was able to be installed from London to South Wales, remembering, of course, that it has to cross the Bristol Channel if it's coming by cable. So we had this experimental link, and whilst the BBC was transmitting television to South Wales, which it did to a transmitter in Cardiff, a new one in Cardiff, we had to man these individual hops. And at one stage, there was a very bad storm which flooded Lynmouth. And I happened to be on duty watching the signal at the site near there, overlooking Linton itself, when the storm hit. All the power went off, but we had a trailer generator, so Muggins had to put his wet weather gear on and crank up the generator. We re-established the link between London and South Wales and carried on. It wasn't until the morning we realised the devastation of Linton and Lynmouth, which had been wiped out by the floods coming down the valley there. So that was one thing that happened on this experimental link. The other one was related to animals, if you like. First of all, the link between the site near Bristol and South Wales was on a flat piece of land, and we had aerials there. We set up the transmitter in a van and put aerials on the telegraph poles in the field, pointing towards Wales, if you like. At night, it worked a treat. In the morning, however, there were no signals. And the problem was pigs. The pigs had eaten up the cable between the aerial and the transmitter. Another example of the influence of animals, which the BBC managed to diplomatically described as a technical hitch, was where, at another site further down the chain, we had another wooden hut with a transmitter and receiver in it. See, you receive the signal and then you retransmit it to go onwards. And this wooden hut had a sort of storm door where you had to enter at right angles through to two doors. There was a technical problem while we were transmitting perhaps the Flower Pot Men or one of those sort of programs, and I was inside trying to fix this technical problem. My colleague was outside looking for the spare fuses. However, also outside was a horse, and the horse was a curious one and quite tame, but he managed to get himself wedged into the storm door. So I was on one side of this damn thing waiting for the fuses. My colleague was on the other side, and we both of us trying to get this horse out from the storm door. And when we re-established communication, the BBC announcer apologised for a technical hitch.
You do lots of talks, and you've been right round the world, pretty much. There's not many places you haven't been, certainly all continents. You were in Cyprus, weren't you? Can you tell us about some of your experiences there?
Yes, well, of course, Cyprus has always historically been subject to other people's interference, the Greeks, the Turks, and all sorts of people have had a go at Cyprus one time or another. Well, I had to go to Cyprus on behalf of GCHQ looking at some equipment there. And whilst there, I was driven from Akrotiria, I think, down to what we call the Panhandle, which is the eastern end of Cyprus. If you look at the map of Cyprus, you'll find it looks a bit like a pan with a handle sticking out towards the east. And I had to go from the western end down to the eastern tip of the Panhandle. And I was taken by an open jeep. Now, when I got into the jeep, I was surprised at the reaction of the driver, because he seemed very nervous. And I discovered why. Because our path was to go down the corridor, which was, in effect, the demarcation line between the Greeks and the Turks after they'd decided on peace. And on each side of this track, which wasn't very wide, perhaps about 100 yards wide, on each side were people with sandbags looking at each other with rifles. And I thought, well, it only needs one to trigger off, and Muggins is in the middle. So I didn't appreciate that. I was looking at the communication facilities, which are government-owned on Cyprus, looking at them for and on behalf of GCHQ at the time. I'll take you back to the Post Office Radio Research in the field in Castledon and Cardiff. There we were developing the ground station equipment for the first communication satellite, Telstar. Now, the first artificial satellite was launched by the Russians, and I think it was 1956, and that was called Sputnik. That was the size of a grapefruit, and it whistled round the planet at heights round about 600 to 1,000 miles above the Earth's surface. All it did was to make beep, 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 beep sounds so that everybody in the world could hear that the Russians had achieved this artificial satellite. It was launched with an elliptical orbit so that if it hit various stardust or whatever, it was proving that it would survive that sort of environment.
So are you saying that the Sputnik didn't actually serve any much purpose as a satellite? Say, for example, you couldn't bounce signals off it, that kind of thing, because that's what the purpose was supposed to be of a satellite.
Yes, it was never intended as a reflector. The only reflector was a balloon which went off very high, and that one you could bounce signals off, as indeed they tried to do with the moon. However, the communication satellite came later, and I think that one is 1956, and that's called Telstar. That was launched from America by NASA, and that one did not stay in stationary position over the Earth. It was not geostationary. So it was only visible between America and UK for, I can't remember the precise figure, but around about half an hour.
So that's very different to the geostationary satellites we have today, because they stay in exactly the same place above the Earth. Yes. In fact, they go round the Earth at the same speed as the Earth turns. And these are the sorts of satellites we use for communications nowadays, and also the ones we use for things like the car sat-navs.
Exactly, yes. Of course, they are much higher in altitude.
If it's only there for half an hour, are you saying you could do a TV program that lasted for half an hour? I mean, how did it work?
You transmit from either US or UK to the satellite. It then regenerates it and transmits it back down to Earth, going whichever way it's going. It was only sufficient to carry one television program, or it could carry about 2,000 odd telephone channels, but it was used for television. And it proved the fact that you could communicate internationally across the Atlantic.
You'd have to plan quite well ahead to make sure you had a little half-hour program just at the right time, and then the thing would disappear.
I'm afraid that was the situation then. But nowadays, the satellites are very much higher, and they are described as geostationary. They stay in one spot over the Earth, and there are, I don't remember how many there are, but if you take one system, there are 42 satellites sitting up above us at this moment. What they do is receive a transmission from Earth, retransmit it down again to a wider area, instead of just, if you like, a pencil torch beam going from city to city. You beam that pencil torch up to the satellite, which then spreads it, if you like, on a circular pattern or oval pattern over a wide area like Europe or whatever. But they do this at a height of more than 23,000 miles above the Earth, because they are stationary. And then that means that you've got a communication channel which is there all the time. The Post Office Radio Research in Castleton developed the some of the equipment which was at Goonhilly, where the main satellite reception aerials and transmitters were and still are. We made some of the ground stations. I never broadcast at all, but we developed the equipment for the ground station. I first retired from GCHQ, I think it was 1984, at which time I would have been 60-odd. In fact, I'd stayed on a couple of years beyond retirement age, but I was headhunted out of there into a small company. One of the companies I was with when I left GCHQ, I was engaged as a technical consultant, mostly on electrical interference matters. They had a contract to the Channel Tunnel Company manufacturing the tunnel. It was an outfit called Transmanche Link, TML for short, and they were making the tunnel for and on behalf of Eurotunnel, who were the client. The tunnel is not one tunnel, it is three. It has two running tunnels, one in each direction, and one in the middle, which is a service tunnel. The two running tunnels have electronic controls for signalling, and so any interference to the signalling system could be catastrophic in terms of what happens to a train in the running tunnel. Remembering that at any one moment there may be something like 20,000 people under the tunnel. The trains in the tunnel are the shuttle, which goes to and from France and England and turns around and goes back again. There's the Eurostar, which goes from London to Paris and with offshoots to Brussels. The signalling system is based on a French signalling system used by the Société Nationale des Chemins de Fer in France, SNCF. And again, if there were any electronic interference with that, there would be problems. Bearing in mind that the trains going through that tunnel are all going at different speeds. The heavy goods trains, with trucks and so forth, will be going relatively slowly. Eurostar will be pedalling along at about 81 miles an hour. And so they have to have electronic controls, knowing where is the train in front, how fast is it going, how long will it take me to put my brakes on to stop hitting it, and what is the indication I get. So all of that is electronically controlled. And so Muggins was a consultant on electrical interference. Bearing in mind, if you think domestically, if your wife has a hairdryer and operates it very close to a television, particularly if it's an old-fashioned television, you'll find that there are noises in the sound. You'll find that there's white spots all over the screen from the interference caused by the hairdryer. When you think about the Channel Tunnel, there are trains going there using electrical power, 25,000 volts between the catenary overhead and the rails, and as they go along, the pickup, the pantograph, sparks, taking enormous power. It's going to be taking the same amount of power as 2,800 2-kilowatt fires. Anyway, if that electrical sparking occurs and interferes with the signalling, then there are problems, serious problems, which could be fatal if the worst should happen. Working on the Channel Tunnel, I found it a fascinating exercise, but I didn't take my shovel, so I was only concerned with the technical aspects.
Are you on the internet?
I am indeed, yes.
I mean, there's a lot of older people, Norman, who don't like using the internet. They find it all a little bit technical and a bit annoying. But you've embraced it, haven't you? Is that just because you think of your communications past? I mean, did you see the internet coming years ago?
No, I didn't. No, I was naive in that respect. during my technical career, I was also involved with some of the satellites. Some of the satellites, which are weather satellites, if you rub a dry surface over your nylon carpet, you'll find that you may get sparks on your on the handle of your door. Well, if you rush a satellite up through the air, the outside becomes charged in that sort of fashion. And so Muggins was also involved in advising on the technical protection against that sort of problem in satellites. So if you like, although I was on the periphery of the Telstar satellites, I was also involved with later satellites. So it's been an interesting life where things has changed a lot. In my time, man has walked on the moon. We've been able to talk across the oceans. Instead of taking weeks to write to Australia, we can now speak in almost real time. Women have become emancipated in that time. During that time, things have improved. Well, they haven't improved very much in Saudi Arabia. In Saudi Arabia, the women cannot drive. They're not allowed to. There was a diplomat who retired recently, and he's reported in the Telegraph as saying that he remembers the king of Saudi Arabia visited on an official visit to UK and was taken by the Queen to see the estate. Team of Land Rovers took outside the palace, and into the passenger seat came Abdullah, and in the back was his translator. And much to his surprise, the person who took the driving wheel was a woman. It happened to be the Queen. Now, he'd never been driven by a woman before, because in Saudi they're not allowed to drive at all. And he was very disturbed because she kept talking to him and taking her eyes off the road. And he asked his translator to please ask the Queen to keep her eyes on the road. Bearing in mind, of course, that the Queen had been a trained driver in the army during the war.
You've been part of the revolution in space technology, but we're now faced with the situation where, you know, some of these satellites might be used for aggressive purposes, even shooting down other satellites. Does that bother you?
Yes and no. First of all, you've got to remember that out in space are asteroids. They are whistling around the sun in a strange orbit. If one of those happens to be coming our way and hits planet Earth, we would no longer be around to comment on it. There is evidence of past asteroids fitted. There was the Tunguska forest in Russia was wiped out in a very large area by a incoming asteroid. Now, if we're able to do the right thing and detect an oncoming asteroid far enough away, we may be able to deflect it away from the planet. We can only do that by firing off a missile of some sort from Earth. So, yes, in times of war, there is the problem of other people shooting down all our communication satellites, but there are so many of them that are unlikely to shoot all of them. Critical ones could be damaged, certainly, but I think on balance, other than actual war, our abilities to shoot things into space, apart from looking for little green men, we now know that there are at least 5,000 other planets around other stars outside our own planet arrangement. And of those 5,000, it may be one or two will have an atmosphere which will support life. However, in order to get there, it would take so long that by the time they got there, the type of civilization which happened to be up there may well have changed anyway. In fact, at one time it was thought that if things got too hot on planet Earth, remembering that the sun is gradually burning out, it's made of hydrogen and getting larger and hotter, eventually, it'll become an enormous red thing which will burn us up. And it was thought at one time we should just smartly whip off to Venus. I don't recommend it at all, because Venus has an atmosphere of sulfuric acid, a pressure 90 times our pressure, and the Russians put a little monitor into Venus, and they discovered that the atmosphere would not support our sort of life at all. In fact, their little probe melted within seconds of entering the Venus atmosphere. On the other hand, we might go to Mars, but again, it takes a fair time to Mars. Don't forget that the there is a vehicle that is currently looking for evidence of water and possible evidence of life. Not life as we know it on Earth, but life in vestigial form.
Some thoughts there about life on other planets from Post Office Radio Research Establishment pioneer, communication expert and author of the Electrical Interference Handbook, Norman Ellis, speaking to me in late 2012. Sad to say, Norman died peacefully in Cheltenham a few months after that interview.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Time for Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide.
Thank you, Tony. Hello, this is your What's On Guide on Dialect. Starting with Friday, 28th of February, Gaz Brookfield will be performing with support from Sam Eason and also Ewan Williams at the Exchange in Old Market, Bristol. Tickets are £7 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 28th of February, the Martin Harley Band will be performing with support from Albert Jones at the Felice in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £13.50 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Rockin' Vickers. This group formed in 1963 in Blackpool, England, and split up in 1967. In their career, they released four singles, and a compilation album was released in 1995. In 1965, Ian Willis, aka Ian Kilmister, aka Lemmy, joined the band until they split up. This is a cover of the Pete Townshend song It's Alright, and it's from the compilation album The Complete Rockin' Vickers.
Rockin' Vickers with It's Alright. Now, in those days, Lemmy was playing guitar and not the bass, as he was in Hawkwind and Motorhead. Into Saturday, 1st of March, John E. Vistic Experience will be performing with support from We Will Have Victory, Yoko Syndrome, The Void, and also Adam Feasey and the Hellcats at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Tickets are £4 in advance, and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Finally, on Sunday 2nd of March, the funk group Monkey Chuckle will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £4 on the door, and the gig starts at 8:30pm. That was all from me. Thanks for listening, and have a good week. Take care, and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers, broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11am every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can download this weekly podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Thanks to our studio guests, Steve Lacey and Norman Ellis, and to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. And you'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Bye for now.
get a gospel dance record as good as Sounds of Blackness's Optimistic or this one, Lisa Taylor's.